on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
The natal chart, you know, is taken as a kind of, it's like a picture of the sky at the moment you were born, in the most basic sense. And the claim that astrologers would make is that that represents a kind of a key to unlocking the understanding of what the zeitgeist was, you know, the kind of collective, the character of the collective psyche at the time when a person was born. And so the basic idea with all astrology, in a personal sense, is that we carry a kind of imprint with us of that time when we were born. We are a manifestation of that zeitgeist, just as all the events that took place on that day in the world are also manifestations of that particular combination of archetypal influences. So, you know, if you were born on a day when the moon was conjunct Saturn, you know, at the same place in the sky from the Earth's perspective, then you're probably someone who values responsibility, duty, honor, those type of things. And if you were to look in the, you know, in the historical archives of things that happened on that day, then you're likely to find, you know, events that also correlate with that particular combination.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by writer and astrologer John Waller to discuss archetypal astrology. John explains how archetypal astrology differs from traditional astrology. He discusses the historical and generational influences of the outer planets, how archetypal astrology encourages interconnectivity rather than individualism, and the value of integrating these planetary archetypes. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Jonathan Waller is an archetypal astrologer, writer, coach, and facilitator. Through his writing and astrological practice, inspired primarily by the work of Richard Tarnas, Wren Butler, and Robert Hand, Jonathan seeks to elaborate, develop, and disseminate the school of archetypal astrology with a particular focus on integrating a realistic critique of Western civilization with the personal, developmental, emotional, psychological, and spiritual insights that the planetary archetypes provide. Jonathan's writing and client work aims to overcome the Western tendency to overstate the importance of the individual at the expense of opportunities to create and tend to bonds of kinship and community spirit. By facilitating sharing circles, courses, and men's groups, Jonathan strives to provide containers and spaces in which spiritual seekers and those pursuing their own growth or healing can find connection and mutual support. Jonathan, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Hey, Nick. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're joining me. You're across the pond, as they say. This is a little bit of a different podcast than I normally do, because typically I am interviewing authors about their books. You do have something coming out in January, which we will talk about a little bit later. But first, I thought that a good place to begin would be this question of what is archetypal astrology for anyone who may be unfamiliar with that?
Yeah, sure. So a good place to start, I guess, is to say that archetypal astrology is a pretty new school of astrology. It's pretty much founded on the work of the astrologer Richard Tarnas, although obviously he in turn is drawing from a lot of previous sources. But most people who call themselves archetypal astrologers are kind of primarily inspired by him. So here's, I guess, the primary difference between archetypal astrology and other schools of astrology is that we focus as archetypal astrologers predominantly on the planets and the aspects or transits. So that just means their geometric relationships that they form from the Earth's perspective. And we don't think too much about signs, houses, the kind of stars that remain in fixed points in the sky, they're a bit further away, asteroids, all these kinds of things. I think most astrologers would agree, and I would say that all these other symbol sets are useful, they're meaningful, they certainly have resonance, and you can certainly work with them as astrologers have done all throughout history. But in archetypal astrology, they're seen as secondary or tertiary systems. The kind of basic idea being that the archetypes associated with the planets are sufficiently complete a set of symbols in and of themselves, and they're kind of sufficiently rich and contain kind of sufficiently complex and diverse sets of associations that we don't need to look much further than them in order to gain kind of significant, meaningful insights. Yeah, does that make sense? Do you think that's gonna?
Yeah, it does. We'll go a little bit deeper, perhaps, maybe with an example. But and I know a little bit about astrology. I studied at the college where Richard Tarnas teaches, but I never took a course with him. I did record an interview with him once, and I'm still working on that
Oh,
project.
great.
But it seems that archetypal astrology resolves an issue with other schools of astrology because there are, for example, all these different house systems. And there's, what is it, the sidereal astrology and Vedic astrology and whatnot. And it seems like by kind of saying, well, the signs, aren't that important, it seems as if it resolves that issue.
It certainly has the potential to provide a kind of astrology that everybody can agree on, or at least that everybody can work on in the same way. We might have disagreements with astrologers in from the Vedic school about precisely what the associations of, say, the moon are or the sun, and that's natural. All these schools have sort of grown up out of their own local mycelium, as it were. But at least if we're just talking about the planets and their relationships to each other and with regards to the Earth, then we can all agree at least on the measurements. Like the planets are where they are. They were where they were. We know where they were at any time in history. We can calculate that with extreme precision. We're y using NASA data. So even the scientists can agree with the astrologers about where the planets were and where they will be. So at least in that sense, we can all agree and work from the same place, with the Like you say, with the signs of the zodiac, there's disagreement about whether we should use the tropical zodiac or the sidereal zodiac. I won't go into too many details about what that means, but for fear of boring or alienating your listeners who are not that into astrology, there's some disagreement about where the signs are, or yeah, where we should plot them on the chart. And with the house systems, there's many different types of house system and many different ways of plotting them on the chart. And a lot of the arguments for which house system you should use kind of rely on this appeal to an ancient authority, which is certainly for me somewhat unpalatable. And I imagine for a lot of people, if they're kind of maybe curious but also skeptical about astrology, then such things might kind of put them off a little bit. If we're kind of saying the reason astrology works is because, well, we found evidence from 2,500 years ago that this is how they did it, and so that's how we should do it now. That's not really my take, and I don't think that's really the position of most archetypal astrologers, although I can't speak for everybody. I think for me, it's much more the case that what archetypal astrology offers is like an opportunity to develop a school of thinking within the astrological lineage that doesn't reject any of the previous systems or the previous ways of doing things, but also is a bit more palatable to the modern sensibility and is perhaps also a bit more relevant. A way of practicing that grows out of our mycelium, the time that we live in, the situations that we find ourselves in. If we can have a way of practicing astrology that seems reasonable to the modern or postmodern or metamodern or hypermodern psyche, then that's going to help us more than having a type of astrology that appeals to the ancient psyche.
Right.
So much wisdom to be gained from understanding those ancient cultures and the way they thought. But I don't think, on the basis of that, we should say, oh, and that's how we should view the sky. That's how we should view mythology. You know, I don't think we can go back to that, even if we determined that it was a good idea.
Okay.
We have to go forward and integrate some more of yeah, where we are really at right now as a people, and let our practices grow out of that.
Okay. And I think that most astrology, and I don't know if there's much difference in the different schools of thought in terms of the, I mean, there will be some local, I think you mentioned, in terms of the archetypes of the planets themselves. So, for example, the archetype of Mars, that's going to be pretty consistent in pretty much every system that you look at, right?
Fairly, you
Yeah.
know, although it has to be said that, you know, the deity in Japan that's associated with the sun is a feminine,
Right.
you know, is a goddess,
Right.
you know, whereas in the Western system, the sun is definitely considered a masculine archetype. And, you know, in India, you know, the moon, oh, I can't. I'm going to do myself a disservice and not be able to remember the name of the god who's associated
Isn't
with,
it Shonda?
yeah,
Something
but
like
again,
that.
a
Yeah.
masculine,
Yeah.
a god as opposed to a goddess. Whereas in the Western system, the moon is definitely an archetype that we associate with femininity, with motherhood, with receptivity, you know. So there are still unresolved mysteries when it comes to these kinds of questions, and I wouldn't be too quick to claim a kind of resolved universality to the system that I use. You know, when you practice divination of any kind, I think it's important to recognize the limits of our ability to understand how it works. And yeah, just leave some room for there to be some continuing mystery about that stuff. You know, it seems to work. I work with my clients. You know, I get good reports from them. I get good feedback. We seem to do meaningful work together. That's my barometer. That's really what I'm interested in, first and foremost. I do have a mind that enjoys like inquiring into these sort of philosophical and these kind of speculative, mysterious areas. But I try to be careful not to get so caught up in that becomes the main thing. You know,
Right.
at the end of the day, I want my work to be helpful
Right.
to clients, and that's what I'm mostly focused on.
Okay. And I think another point of similarity is there's a focus on the natal charts, what the sky was like at the moment you were born. And I seem to recall that Carl Jung, and we can take sort of modern archetypal theory back to him, thought that it was one of the best indicators of someone's psychology, of someone's psyche.
Yeah, I mean he certainly used astrological charts, especially when he had patients or clients that were less forthcoming with him. I think he felt the same way about his own personality typology, which now has kind of evolved into Myers-Briggs and things like that. You know, I think a lot of astrologers are very quick to claim the allegiance of Jung, and he certainly was interested in astrology and his own personal study of it, and he certainly did use it with his clients. But it's important, I think, to acknowledge as well that he wasn't openly an astrologer.
Right.
He would mention it, but he wouldn't tell his clients that he was conducting astrological studies of their birth charts. And he was skeptical of any kind of systematizing approach of the psyche in preference of like this more open dialogical approach. So I think he used his own personality typing systems when his clients like didn't open up to him and share what needed to be shared of their own volition. And my intuition is that he used astrology in much the same way. So there is a kind of endorsement from Jung there. But again, you know, it's not like he wrote a lot of words, Carl Jung.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you dive into his collected works, you see just how much he wrote. It was a lot. not a huge amount of it concerns astrology, you
Right,
know.
right.
Some of it does, and he certainly had a brilliant astrological mind, in the same way that he had a brilliant, you know, mind for understanding the like symbolism in general, whether that be in religious practice or mythology or wherever he found it. So yeah, that's my take on Jung and astrology. But yeah,
Thank you.
try reading Ion. It's really good, but it's
Yeah.
extremely hard to read,
Yeah,
like
I
all of his
have,
books.
yeah, I have read Ion. There is, this is a little bit off topic, but new translations have just been released
Oh,
because
wow.
before all we had were the, I think Hull was the translator. And now there are new translations. And one of the critiques of Jung is that his writing is notoriously difficult to penetrate. And I'm kind of personally curious if the new translations help at all. But you know, again, that's a little bit off topic here.
I'll certainly look into it. You know, Jung's writing in that about the age of Pisces, you know, the
Right.
Platonic month that lasts a couple of thousand years, and the kind of relating the age of Christianity with the age
Right.
of Pisces, and the kind of the rising of the Christ myth in the first 2,000 years, and the kind of falling of it in the second 1,000 years, and the, you know, moving into the age of Aquarius. I think it's all extremely poetic and really
Yeah.
profound in places. But yeah, it's hard to penetrate Jung's so-called academic writing,
Right.
you know, even with a long and detailed study of it. He's often referencing texts that you couldn't even get your hands on, and even if you could, you wouldn't understand what they meant.
Right,
And
right,
so
right.
it's just hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he is our sort of modern champion of archetypes, I think.
Oh, big fan.
Yeah, as am I, as am I. So with the archetypal astrology, there's the you look at the natal chart, we look at the positions of the planets and the relationships between the planets. And then on an individual basis, you would look at current transits and how they relate to the natal planets, right?
Yes. So the natal chart, you know, is taken as a kind of, it's like a picture of the sky at the moment you were born, in the most basic sense. And the claim that astrologers would make is that that represents a kind of a key to unlocking the understanding of what the zeitgeist was, you know, the kind of collective, the character of the collective psyche at the time when a person was born. And so the basic idea with all astrology, in a personal sense, is that we carry a kind of imprint with us of that time when we were born. We are a manifestation of that zeitgeist, just as all the events that took place on that day in the world are also manifestations of that particular combination of archetypal influences. So, you know, if you were born on a day when the moon was conjunct Saturn, you know, at the same place in the sky from the Earth's perspective, then you're probably someone who values responsibility, duty, honor, those type of things. And if you were to look in the, you know, in the historical archives of things that happened on that day, then you're likely to find, you know, events that also correlate with that particular combination. And so where it gets a little bit more complex and like a bit more interesting for individual clients, you know, is we can look at the, we can put two charts together, essentially. We can put the chart of today, superimposed or in a circle around your natal chart, and see what kinds of aspects are being formed by combinations of the places where the planets were when you were born and where they are now. So you might not have been born with a moon Saturn conjunction, but you will have one every lunar cycle, you know,
Right.
because every lunar cycle the moon makes a complete circuit of the chart. So every 28 days or so, it's going to pass over where Saturn was when you were born. And, you know, if you journal and pay attention to your inner experience and also keep track of the lunar cycle, then that might be a good way to do a personal inquiry into, like, oh, whether or not there's any validity to these claims.
Right,
You know, and
right.
most people, I think, if you If there's a joke in the astrology world that, a lot of people who now work as astrologers are people who were very critical of astrology and decided, because they were so critical of it, to undertake a serious study of it in order to disprove it, and then just ended up practicing it. So, yeah, that's a bit of an aside to your question, but.
If I remember right from Richard Tarnas's Cosmos and Psyche, that's kind of what happened to him. He was trying to, in a sense, disprove it and then ended up practicing.
Well, if you've recorded a conversation with him, I won't bother to maybe elucidate that story too much, but
Oh, well, our conversation was actually about Stan Grof. I'm working on a project about Stan Grof, and so I was interviewing some folks about him.
Oh,
And I
great.
know that Grof is important in Richard Tarnas's work with astrology as well.
And important to me personally too. But yeah, it was in an effort to understand, or perhaps even try to predict the effect that LSD would have on patients in their therapeutic sessions in the 70s, that it was initially suggested to Grof and Tarnas that they look at transits and birth charts to see if there was any clues. And yeah, they were both very, very skeptical about the idea when it was suggested to them, but they gave it a go, being open-minded, and much to their dismay initially, I would imagine, found that there were significant correlations between the character of people's experience in psychedelic therapy and the planetary transits that they are undergoing at the time. It makes sense in a way, but you can think of psychedelics as amplifying the ongoing material in the psyche, making it bigger. And that's the kind of inner experience, a subjective experience, is probably the best place to observe the archetypal influences on us. And normally those things can be quite subtle, but you take a 500 milligrams of LSD and put a blindfold on, all of that stuff suddenly gets a little bit bolder and brought more into focus. So it gives you a good opportunity to test whether the claims of archetypal astrology are worthwhile. So that's a that story, when I heard Richard Tarnas in an interview telling that story, that's what first made me start to consider giving any credence at all to astrology. Before that, I also was very skeptical.
I will tell you what put me on a path of being a little less skeptical and more willing to accept it was planetary alignments right before the pandemic. I know a
Oh,
lot of
yeah.
astrologers were saying something big's coming. Something big's coming. And I think it was three planets, right? It was Pluto, Saturn, and Jupiter.
Well, we had been in a long like square alignment, so 90 degree alignment between Pluto and Uranus, which was still ongoing. We're just coming to the end of it. And at the time, that lasted from 2007 to 2021. And those two planets, when they come together, typically kind of preside over periods of rebellion, kind of a lot of freedom seeking activity. That a similar period coincided with the French Revolution, it kind of the exact 12-year period that is now historically referred to as the French Revolution. Again, from 1960 to 1972, there was a conjunction between Pluto and Uranus. And so the square between 2007 and 2021, think about that time we had at the beginning of it, the Arab Spring and kind of wave of revolutionary activity in the Middle East and the Arab world. And then we had the Occupy movement, and of course, Me Too and Black Lives Matter and a whole raft of other things that happened in that time. And then, yeah, just before COVID, well, kind of precisely in coincidence with the beginning of COVID, Saturn, which is a planet that has much more to do with restrictions, limitations, obstacles, problems. It does have good sides as well. All the archetypes are multivalent, They can influence us for positive or negative, towards positive or negative ends, depending on how we respond and depending what kind of situation they arrive into. But yeah, Saturn came into a tight conjunction with Pluto over throughout COVID. And yeah, I mean, lockdown
Right.
is a very Saturn Pluto kind of a word. And Rick Tarnas pretty much anticipated that a pandemic was a likely possibility, having established a pattern in throughout history. You know, he's an amazing historian as well as astrologer, philosopher, and that's kind of what laid the groundwork for archetypal astrology as a discipline, is his historical research. And one of the things you can do, it's very easy to do it now, is wind back the planetary clock and see, well, what happened when Saturn Pluto were conjunct, you know, in the 1800s, and what happened when they were opposite, you know, at the beginning of the 1900s, and what happened. And so you can establish all the types of things that tend to happen in those sequences. And yeah, pandemics is one of those. And I guess a lot of experts as well had kind of been saying for a while, it's been a while since our
Yeah.
last pandemic. And so it's not always about finding every little detail in the chart. You have to also kind of be aware of what's going on in the world and have the kind of historical understanding and that depth of knowledge as well, that gives you know, that contributes to your potential for insight as a practitioner.
Right. Yeah, thank you for that. And I wanted to touch on this because you're kind of taking us in that direction in a sense, is that there is different ways of focusing on this. You know, I began by talking about the natal charts, and that's all individual, but then there is a collective aspect, which is what you were just talking about. And even individually with the outer planets, that sometimes seems to give a sort of generational color or color to a generation. I know my generation, I think it was the I think Pluto and Uranus conjunction.
Whereas for me, I was born in the late 80s, and throughout the late 80s and the 90s, Uranus was not conjunct Pluto, but conjunct Neptune. So where Pluto is a very raucous energy and has to do with kind of the return of the repressed and the kind of dealing with the shadow and the kind of instinctive and animalistic Dionysian side of humanity, Neptune is a little more idealistic in some senses, and it really has more to do with kind of unitive experiences of transcendent, and kind of the call to remember our interconnectedness with one another. So the 90s was a time where Uranus plays the role of awakening, and what was being awakened, obviously, in the 60s was that Dionysian energy. And what was being awakened by Uranus in the 90s as a bit softer, you know, it's like the difference between the Rolling Stones and Enya is a very good parallel to draw. So obviously the outer planets, they move a lot more slowly than the inner planets. So yeah, everyone born between 1960 and 1972 had that conjunction between Pluto and Uranus. There's a lot of variation in there as well, because the faster moving planets also have a big influence, and they'll be different from week to week, month to month, year to year. That's why often the outer planets are kind of referred to as generational planets.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about something that's in the bio. And this is a where it stated that you have a focus on integrating a realistic critique of Western civilization. And I was wondering if you could maybe speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a big deal for me. I think I see it as a generally kind of a failing in the astrological world, in the kind of New Age diaspora in general, and something that I'm keen to, like, such as I can, you know, like, address that at least in the way that I practice. So how that comes up in astrology, you know, we might say that our culture, Western cultures in general, and I'm using a broad brush, so I'll just throw that out there and acknowledge that. But, you know, we might say something like our culture has a pathological relationship with the solar archetype and with the Saturn archetype. So with the sun has to do with individualism, has to do with our ability and our desire to make our mark on the world, to kind of express ourselves creatively, to be the hero in our own stories. And, you know, in the astrological system, this is kind of counterbalanced by the moon, you know, by the lunar archetype, which has more to do with bonds of kinship and receptivity and tending to one another, tending to the earth, tending to the community, giving, introspection, you know, where the sun has to do with thinking and intellect to some degree. You might include, you know, that's kind of some crossover with Mercury there, but certainly the sun has to do with intellect. The moon has more to do with feeling, you know, where the sun has to do with career and our kind of achievements in the outer world. You know, the moon has more to do with family and that more reflective kind of the night world, the dream world. So I think it's important, I'll leave Saturn out of it for now, but I think it's important when practicing astrology that we recognize those kind of biases. You know, it's not, I don't see the chart as a definitive, like final, I don't think many astrologers do, like picture of the person, you know. I think even the word blueprint, which gets thrown around a lot, is a bit too prescriptive. You know, every person, and when I get into a reading with somebody and I have a person sat across from me, it's important that I understand the ways in which the pathology of the culture that they've grown up in is bound to have affected them.
Yeah.
So, and just be able to speak to that. And, you know, there's just things that are worth at least giving some thought to. Like if I'm going to talk about Uranus and I'm going to talk about liberation and emancipation, and say an African American person books a reading with me, it's like, how comfortable am I? Like, it's one thing for me to sit here and tell you about the parts of your psyche that yearn for liberation and emancipation, but how comfortable am I when I'm talking to, you know, somebody whose ancestors not so long ago were enslaved by people who look just like me? You know, there's some work for me to do there to make sure I'm ready to have those conversations. So yeah, this is a little bit about it, but if you have any like kind of follow-up questions, if that's brought anything up, I'm happy to speak to it more.
Yeah, well, it seems like there's multiple ways of critiquing Western civilization, and I appreciate this. When you were speaking, one of the things that I was thinking about is my background is in large part in the history of religions. And I was thinking about prior to the advent of the monotheistic traditions that, and I don't necessarily want to refer to it as a goddess culture because there's some questions around that, but there was the instance where the divine feminine was much more active in human consciousness. I think I'll phrase it that way. And then that got replaced by the solar hero in many ways. And we are still driving in that car. You know, it's nearly every movie and book, it's all of the hero's journey, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll maybe go one step further, if I may be so bold, the pagan heretic that I am.
Yeah.
And say, you know, I often end up in conversations where I hear the rhetoric being bandied around, oh, you shouldn't, as a Westerner, it's not going to work for us to use Eastern symbolism. You know, we have to go back to our Western traditions and understand the mystical heart of those traditions. And like, yeah, okay. But generally what follows after that is an exhortation to understand Christianity, Islam, Judaism. And, you know, I'm not expert in any of those, but I was, you know, I did grow up going to church and was raised a Christian, and I'm not like traumatized by it, but I think it's important to recognize that the role of Christianity in particular as a force for, you know, it's been a boot for standing on the neck of the feminine since day one. And so don't tell me that's my heritage and that's what I have to work with. It's like, fine, you want me to work with Western symbols, I'll go back a bit further, you know, or I'll examine the traditions that have like struggled to survive, you know, despite the oppression that's been visited upon them by the patriarchal religions. That said, you know, there is a mystical core to all those religions. There is something worth, like deeply worth investigating and deeply understanding. And I'm really up for that. But at the same time, you know, I feel like it's still appropriate to kind of say, hey, that's not all I have, you know, as a so-called Westerner.
No, I agree with that. And I would never really suggest that. I think that people are searching for alternatives to the Western traditions that we've been raised in. And I think there's a lot of concern, and rightfully so, with things like cultural appropriation. However, cultures have been sharing ideas and symbols from the beginning. And, you know, and I think that's okay. And it's, you know, I take a lot from the Eastern traditions. And I don't even want to say I take a lot, but I've been inspired by the Eastern traditions. But with my initial comment, what I also see happening now is a little bit more of a rejection of the patriarchal monotheistic traditions and the rebirth of the divine feminine and rebirth of this idea of moving away from individualism towards more communal thinking.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I feel that too. You know, there's days when I feel it more than others. There's times when I feel really hopeful about it, and other times when I feel the struggle of it more. You know, especially as an astrologer, you get into a lot of, you know, the kind of, oh, we've just met, what do you do for a living type conversation, you know, can lead to some real feeling of hopelessness in that regard, because you get to see just how rigidly masculine and patriarchal the Western mind can be. But yeah, you know, other times I have conversations like this, and I meet other people like yourself, and I feel good about it. And it does certainly seem as though the collective mind is slowly opening or slowly remembering, oh, hey, there's other options here. We don't have to continue down this road. In fact, we probably shouldn't. So, yeah.
Well, it also seems that where astrology and archetypal astrology fit into this critique of Western civilization is with this paradigm that we have, this current paradigm of everything's just matter, everything is cause and effect. And I think one of the criticisms of astrology is, well, the planets aren't going to affect us. But there's a different way of thinking. It's a different kind of cosmology, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would never suggest that like Jupiter is emitting some kind of force that's undetectable to science, that's like changing all of our mood simultaneously, making us all feel more buoyant and lucky. You know, it's more like, if you imagine that the movements of the planets, right, they're very regular. It's not that much of a stretch to draw a comparison with the inner workings of a clock, right? So the thing about a clock is, and this is one of Richard Tarnas's metaphors, or at least I heard him first say it. I don't know if he got it from somewhere else, but you know, the just because a clock tells you what the time is, that's no reason to therefore form a belief that the clock is the source of time itself, and that if the clock stopped, then time would stop. You know, that's a clearly we all agree that's a nonsensical belief. It's also kind of useful metaphor to just speak to the variety of systems of divination that are out there, to say, you know, just because you've designed a clock and you find out that it works, no reason to assume that that's the one and only clock design worth pursuing. But you know, I would also then say one more thing on that metaphor, which is like, once you have a really good design, which I would say archetypal astrology is, no need to carry on like seeking out more and more designs for clocks. You know, once you can tell the time, just tell the time and get busy living. There could be a tendency to go, oh well, what if I integrated this and this and this system and that system, and what if I feel like if I understood every branch of astrological practice and I understand the tarot and the I Ching, and then I'll really be able to say for sure what's going to happen in the future. And that's not my vibe. I'm more about using these systems and sets of symbols to help us encounter life in the present moment, with kind of arms open wide, with as much acceptance and kind of open-hearted yet surrender as we can muster.
Yeah, the other area that I can see this as being a critique of Western ideas, perhaps, is, and I apologize, I don't remember the exact wording that you used, but it was in regards to the natal chart, that it was this picture at that moment that you were born, but that you're embodying that in a sense. So, in a sense, you are embodying the universe, and it creates this connection between you and the universe.
Yeah, it's very validating in many ways, especially if you're going through hard times, to see, first of all, there's a correlation. This is kind of ordained, and like, yeah, that might be hard to accept. Oh, the universe is delivering me hard times, but also, this has an expiration date on it. And also, this is the type of experience that everybody goes through. You're going to have your own unique, like, experience of it. Each transit, each combination of the moving planets with your natal planets, you're going to experience that in the context of your own life, and it's going to be different from how other people experience it. There will nonetheless be a coherent, discernible, meaningful pattern that you can see there. And even if you are going through hard times, just to know, to feel, to look into your kind of suffering and see how it connects you, with other people, with all the other beings on the planet, with the cosmos itself, that can be very helpful to help to kind of, yeah, just establish that sense of meaning. There's nothing that isn't meaningful in the astrological system.
Yeah,
And so really,
I'm sorry, that's another critique, because in our Western paradigm right now, there is no inherent meaning.
yeah, so it's the direct opposite of that, and I could speak to the kind of, the different metaphysical systems, like, oh, do we say matter is primary? Do we say consciousness is primary? My instinct again is that that's going to remain a mystery for quite some time. I'm certainly not going to be the one to resolve it. I think, there's a great deal of value in materialism, and not many astrologers would say that. But, we're sitting here talking on our computers, like recording a podcast, because of materialism, or at least because it's being made possible by developments that have come from approaching the universe in this way. So there is value there. But I think it's a drastically incomplete picture of the universe that we arrive at if we assume, if we, start from the assumption that there's no meaning inherent in the universe, and that the only that what meaning is a kind of perhaps even an illusory emanation from the kind of meaningless bashing together of particles under the influence of, uncaring physical forces. I think we miss out on a lot of insight and kind of beneficial possibilities for living if we only approach the universe in that way. And if we also approach it as if the universe itself is in some sense made of consciousness, and it's not just that meaning is emerging through a kind of process of complexification, but also that the meaning is inherent and that matter is emerging from, and that all of this kind of reflects itself in a Möbius strip that we're only ever able to see one side of at a time. That's kind of my jam with all of that. I don't know how to I never know how to construct that argument in a way that would stand up against someone who's
Right.
picked a side, but that's my intuition, and it feels good to me, so that'll do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are always anomalies in every paradigm, and it's the anomalies that lead us to another one. But you still maintain what worked from the previous paradigm. It's not coming from scratch, you know. So, you know, like you said, we're able to have this conversation because of materialistic science. So now I understand that you have kind of switching here a little bit towards the end, that you have a Oracle deck coming out, I believe January 2025, the Archetypal Astrology Oracle. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So what it is a 55 card deck. I guess anyone who's familiar with Oracle decks will understand what that is straight away. For those who aren't, there's 55 cards, and each one of them has a piece of artwork on it that represents, there's one for each of the planetary archetypes, so the sun, moon, and each of the planets in the solar system. And then there's also a card for every combination of two. So that's 55 altogether. And then there's also a guidebook with a chapter for each card that explains the kind of core significance of each archetype and of each combination of two, and gives some sort of insight into the life-enhancing possibilities and the challenges that might come up when they're kind of activated mutually or singularly in the chart. And then there's lots of suggestions of activities, practices, ways of engaging with these energies that will help you to develop them as a part of yourself or get to know them and deepen your understanding. So it's great for people who are already interested in astrology and want to use it to, like, as a way to deepen their own self-knowing, as well as, people who are looking for a fun and interesting, creative and evocative, not merely intellectual way to approach learning about astrology.
Yeah, it seems like it's a very different kind of learning tool for astrology because astrology is difficult. It is very difficult to learn. So I think that, you know, I'm curious, it seems like it's this teaching tool for that, but it can also serve as an oracle.
So it can be used the same way that there's various different ways you can use it. The simplest way, especially for people who don't already have a kind of astrological practice, whether that's personal or professional, whatever, the simplest way is just to use it the same way one would use any oracle deck. So you can just, shuffle the deck, pull a card, pull three cards, pull whatever kind of formation of cards you like or are used to pulling, and just, see what it is. Maybe leave it on a windowsill or a mantelpiece or an altar to be thought-provoking. Read the chapter in the book that relates to it. Maybe try out one of the suggested practices or activities, and just use it in a very intuitive way, the same way. I don't want to kind of demean the tarot by saying that this is the same thing, because obviously there's a whole history and lineage and art to the tarot. So this is perhaps like a bit less of a bit less doesn't require any formal training or understanding, and so it's not quite that, but it can certainly be used in that way. It's while you or I is only going to have certain transits active at any one time, or you or I might only have certain combinations of the planets as natal aspects in the birth chart, throughout life you're going to experience every combination of any two planets at some time or another. So if you pull a card and it doesn't relate to a transit that you're having at the moment, and you don't have it as a natal aspect, you'll probably find, if you were to look into it, that what it brings up for you to read the stuff in the book, there's my original poetry in there as well. It's another way to, like, kind of go straight to the emotional side of the learning experience and not rely so heavily on the intellectual side of it. But yeah, you probably find that when you read that stuff and you look at the art and you let the emotions come up, that it might bring up material that's related to experiences that you had when you did have that transit ongoing. And so once you've had a transit, the experiences that you have in that transit don't go anywhere. they become a part of you and you carry that with you. So yeah, it's quite an open approach to astrology that I have. It's not so much about precise timings,
Right.
you know, it's more about, yeah, just deepening understanding in a very permissive way, whatever comes up. So it also can be used, you know, if you do have an astrological practice and you know how to track your transits, you know which ones are ongoing at what times, then you could get the appropriate cards out. You know, you don't just, you just go through the deck and find them and leave them on your mantelpiece or altar as a reminder. You know, that's what's happening at this time. You can read the chapters of the book and just keep that stuff in mind. Yeah, and if you're doing readings for people as well, that's another great possibility, especially doing in-person readings when you're talking about sitting across from somebody, talking about their Sun, Jupiter, you know, trine. You can get the card out and lay it on the table and just leave it as a
Right.
kind of extra visual aid to help your clients or friends
Yeah.
understand. So yeah, I hope it's fun and creative, and yeah, like I keep saying, I hope it kind of short circuits the this kind of slightly over reliance on words that is
Right.
so typical
Right.
of astrological practice. You know, it can just be a lot of words.
Yeah.
And then the question is always, well, what do we do with it?
Yeah.
So I hope
Yeah.
it helps us to expand in that way.
Yeah. Well, I appreciated how in the guidebook that comes with it, you look at the beneficial and challenging aspects to the archetypes and the planet combinations. And I will add also, I was looking at it from, I do read tarot and I like to use correspondences. So they're in the classic Rider-Waite-Smith deck, if you know how to look for them, but they are specifically stated in like Crowley's Thoth deck. But what's different is the combinations that you use, the planetary combinations, because in the tarot, the correspondences are always going to be planets and signs. And looking at what you wrote about the planets, just the individual planets, I think that's going to be your most where you're going to find most of the similarity, like the, because there is a sun card in tarot, there is a moon card, but with Venus, I can, it's like, oh yes, well, that's the Empress card, and what you wrote made sense. So it's something new with the planetary combinations. And I would say that the way that you present it, it would actually benefit tarot readers because you give a little bit extra depth to it, especially with those planetary archetypes.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that, and I'm glad. You know, there's that. Someone said it. All true maps converge. You know, they
Yeah.
should map onto it. If something works, if a system works, then it should map onto all the other systems that work.
Yeah.
So I'm happy for that kind of
Yeah. Yeah.
convergence.
Yeah. 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 It's, and I've only seen the artwork in black and white. Looking forward to seeing the color versions, I think. I may have seen a few in the color, but yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, the guidebook's going to be printed in black and white.
Right. Right.
You know,
Yeah.
publishers have their
Yeah.
requirements.
Yeah. Well, it would be wicked expensive if it was all in color, I think.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah,
And you have the
purpose.
cards.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like a really fun thing that you'll be able to do with it. I know we're kind of running out of time, but like you could treat each planet as a suit, you know, so that you could have all the sun cards. You get the sun card, and then you get the sun moon card, the sun Mercury card, the Sun Venus card, the Sun Mars card, and so on all the way through to Pluto,
Yeah.
and lay them all out together, and maybe read all those chapters if you're feeling like a little bit of study. And by doing that, you'll see the full spectrum of what the sun archetype can be.
Right.
Because the fact is, like, it's easy in a way to imagine that we just need to list the archetypes and understand each one of them. But the fact is, they're all there all the time.
Right.
And they're all constantly interacting with one another in one way or another. So they don't exist in isolation from each other. So yeah, I hope I can't wait to get my hands on the deck itself. It's being printed, I think, as we speak. So yeah, when that's something I'm looking forward to doing, is kind of making these tableaus, you know, seeing the sun in all of its different shades, seeing the moon in all of its different shades, and doing that with each one. yeah, that should be a fun and interesting like activity
Yeah.
for me and any budding astrologer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another way of using it is a teaching tool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, as you noted, we are unfortunately running out of time here. So, let me ask you the final questions, which is, what are you working on next? What have you got coming up? We know this is coming out, the Oracle deck will come out in January, but what else have you got going on?
Yeah, so I'm just, as we speak, I'm just about to launch into the first cohort of a new course that I'm offering called Soul Work, which is like a combination of everything that I use for myself in my own spiritual practice. So there'll be some archetypal astrology in there, a few talks with a lot of, I'll probably use the artwork from the cards and speak some poetry and play some music and evoke the archetypes and various different pairings. But that's not going to be all of it. It's going to be a lot of group dialogue, kind of therapeutic group work. There's going to be mindfulness practices that my colleague Barbara Carter is going to be leading. There's going to be a breathwork and neurodynamic breathwork session led by another friend of mine, Jonathan Schechter. And the idea is we're going to have a lot of tools for doing introspective work and then bringing that into an interpersonal forum, and then also seeing how that interpersonal stuff also is reflected on a kind of wider sociological and cosmological level, and then kind of bringing that back down into the introspective level and sort of doing this oscillation and doing that kind of work together, kind of benefiting from a sense of supportive community. So I expect by the time this comes out, I'll be gearing up for the second cohort of that. People can find out a lot more about that on my website. There's a whole page
Okay.
kind of dedicated to that. So I'm really
And
excited about that.
the website is
www.johnwallercoach.com. So
okay.
that's JONWALLER coach. No H in John.
Okay. All right. I will put a link for that in the show notes and the video description. And once the Archetypal Astrology Oracle comes out, I can go back and insert that as well so people
Great.
can find it fairly
It's great. It
easily.
is available to pre-order on Amazon right now, so
Okay.
should be able to link to it
Okay.
if people want to check that out. And of course, I'm available for readings. I offer readings in various different shapes and sizes. So yeah, I aim to suit everybody's different needs and requirements to the extent that that's possible. So yeah, if you're interested in getting some insight from me about your natal chart, your transits, or if you have like particular questions that you'd like astrological insight into or life situations that you could just use some support with, yeah, feel free, check out my website, send me an email.
All right, wonderful. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for your time this morning. I learned a lot. I appreciated how well you articulated all of this that can be really challenging. So I'm
Thank you.
very, very grateful for it. So thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks for the platform to talk about this stuff. It's really important to me, so I appreciate it. And yeah, I appreciate your sensitivity and the way you ask the questions. Being a great host, I
Oh,
appreciate it. Thank you
well,
very
thank you.
much.
I appreciate that as well.
And that's a wrap on episode 159 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming up next, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media too, please, and subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But here's the thing. All of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. So I always like to say I'm here in the Front Range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.